It is Monday, August 27th, 2012. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. KUAF is supported by Arcom Printing, located on the hillside just east of Township and College Intersection in Fayetteville. Arcom Printing provides printing, copying, and digital output services. ArcomPrinting.com or 444-7711. The KUAF website giveaway in Walton Arts Center offering you the chance to win two tickets to the 10x10 Art Series. This series includes 10 performances from jazz, dance, theater, classical, and world music performances. The drawing is Friday, September 14th, during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Registration and information available at KUAF.com. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large, the Sack Lunch Program in Fort Smith. By the end of the year, 50,000 free lunches will have been created and handed out. And Noises Off opens the seventh season for Theater Squared. We'll have a conversation with the director of the production, Morgan Hicks, as well as the managing director of Theater Squared, Martin Miller. That and much more ahead on Ozarks at Large. First, although city directors have now voted in favor of citywide automated trash collection, a petition organizer in Fort Smith is moving forward with efforts to gain additional signatures to have the issue on the November ballot. According to thecitywire.com, Fort Smith resident Joel Culberson says that the vote for automation effort will pursue gathering 10 additional signatures and revising the ballot language needed for a vote to automate all trash collection operations in the city. This comes after city directors voted 7-0 Thursday night for the sanitation department to move forward with citywide automation. The unanimous vote in favor of automation came after 6 months of the board voting 4-3 against the plan. If Thursday night's vote stands, which was added to the board's agenda at the last minute, then the decision can be overturned by a simple majority of 4 directors' votes. But if the issue is brought to a public vote, then it would take 5 directors for a reversal. Construction efforts may already be hampering travel around the University of Arkansas campus in Fayetteville, but another street is going to be closed for construction near the university. Yesterday, city street crews began work on Dixon Street between Gregg and University Avenues. Keith Shreve of the city's transportation department says the crews are working to replace crosswalks in the area.
Well, we're getting some deterioration in the bricks and the concrete that holds the brick in place. They're becoming trip hazard for the pedestrians and just rough to drive over if you were in a car. They were just getting in poor condition and we needed to make some repairs.
The crosswalks will be replaced with the same brick-laid type of crosswalks that have become characteristic of Fayetteville's downtown area. Shreve says that the work will take just a few weeks. Shreve says that while traffic may be closed to one lane, the sidewalks along Dixon Street will remain open through the duration of the work. According to the city website, crews will work along the stretch between 7 in the morning and 3:30 in the afternoon. The street will reopen to regular traffic at night. As forecasters continue monitoring the strength and trajectory of Tropical Storm Isaac, a dozen members of the Arkansas Red Cross have been dispatched to Florida to aid preparation efforts. Bridget Williams with the Arkansas Red Cross is already on the ground in Florida.
The Arkansans who are en route are going to provide various services, including mental health in the event, obviously, that the storm hits. We also have our emergency trucks going down, which will obviously be needed for mobile feeding and providing other disaster supplies. There are more than 20 shelters on standby across southern Florida, and we have crews there waiting and able to open those up immediately as needed.
Williams says crews from Arkansas will be in the Tampa area and other locations further north in the state as the storm moves. According to the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, Isaac is expected to make landfall sometime tomorrow. But Arkansas reportedly won't see any of the rain from the storm until later in the week. Governor Mike Beebe says Arkansas will be one of 8 states to begin initiating new health care reform laws. These new efforts will focus on patient outcomes, prevent duplication of diagnostic tests, and offer incentives to physicians who provide enhanced care for their patients. In his weekly radio address, the governor also said he wants the state to be ahead of the curve when implementing these reforms.
Arkansas's initiative has the potential to slow the rise of health care costs, temper the cost demands on our taxpayers, and make Medicaid more sustainable. It is a bold undertaking in an industry already changing after the passage of the Affordable Care Act.
Governor Beebe says he believes the new initiatives will ultimately slow the rise of health care costs and lessen the monetary demands on taxpayers. The Razorback soccer team is no longer undefeated after a loss yesterday in Dallas. The Hogs lost 4-0 to SMU. Arkansas will next play in Fayetteville, 7 p.m. Sunday, when they'll host Kennesaw State. The 19th Arkansas Razorback volleyball season is underway. The Razorbacks opened with their own Arkansas Invitational in Barnhill Arena this weekend, winning matches against UT Martin, Northwestern State, and Kansas. Arkansas will continue their home season Tuesday night against Tulsa at 7 at Barnhill Arena. For the Northwest Arkansas Naturals, the weekend didn't go as well. After a 3-2 win on Friday against the Springfield Cardinals, the Nats lost two games in Tulsa against the Drillers. The Nats play again tonight at 7:05 in Tulsa. Partly cloudy tonight, lows of 66 in northwest Arkansas for the Arkansas River Valley. 20% chance of rain, maybe a thunderstorm under partly cloudy conditions. Lows tonight in the River Valley in the mid-70s. Tomorrow, clear. Highs will be between 90 and 97 throughout the listening area. And for tomorrow night, clear with lows in the lower 60s. This is Ozarks at Large.
This is a lunch that was made today, am I right? A meat sandwich, milk. One day a week we serve milk.
Twice today, volunteers have gathered in a building in downtown Fort Smith to prepare and hand out sack lunches to anybody who asks.
Now milk is expensive, it's like buying gas. And so each week the price of the milk fluctuates, okay? So this is like gold here.
That's Gene Koljeski, one of the co-directors of the Sack Lunch program on 6th Street in downtown Fort Smith.
And they get a dessert, a sandwich, a drink, and they get fruit.
Before the year is over, more than 50,000 such lunches will have been given to people who just walk up to a door across the street from St. John's Episcopal Church. Last Thursday afternoon, Linda McDonough, Gene Koljeski, and Kim Pearson were putting meat, cheese, and mustard on bread and placing those sandwiches inside brown paper sacks. The lunches would be handed out the next day. Linda and Gene are two of the three co-directors of the program. Kim is a board member. Over the course of a month, the Sack Lunch program will have hundreds of volunteers preparing lunches in this room, then handing them out through a serving door. Gene Koljeski walks to a bulletin board in a hallway outside of this room and points to a picture of Mary Wise, a parishioner at St. John's Episcopal Church who started the program on her own, modestly, in 1986.
She would see hungry people outside the church because we have the bus station right over there, and it bothered Mary tremendously. So she started bringing Vienna sausage and crackers from home and serving the people, anybody that she saw. And as time went on, the priest from over there said, share your ministry with the church. So the church started to do this and started at St. John's. And so they supported it. It was like this little secret, and it was just St. John's who did this.
Since then, another 16 churches and organizations have become involved. Every Monday through Friday morning, free basic meals are given out for a half hour beginning at 8:30 and 11:30. Another meal is available Saturday mornings at 11:30. Kim Pearson, a board member and volunteer for the program, says in an effort to maximize resources, the lunch program only offers one meal over the weekend.
One thing that Gene is also very good at is finding other services that are available in town and not duplicating those services. And so there are a lot of churches that serve on Saturdays, and there are a lot more that serve on Sundays.
There is a fierce dedication among the directors to stretch limited assets as far as they can. The program is all volunteer. Nobody gets paid. Through grants, in-kind help, and donations, each meal costs only 63 cents to produce. Volunteers drive from Fayetteville and Oklahoma to help on their assigned days. Gene Koljeski keeps track of all of this on an elaborate color-coded sheet in the hallway.
This is my schedule. It kind of gives you an idea. I have over 300 volunteers now who come through, and I really can't tell you how many volunteers I have because people bring their friends. Kim brings her whole homeschool group, which could be 20 kids that I don't even know about. But on my list, I have about 300 volunteers that I keep on my email list, and I send out monthly emails to. And this is how the calendar goes.
The precision of her planning is impressive. For today's date, August 28th, there is a notation that says, Bill Chandler, bananas.
Bill Chandler goes and picks up bananas from Sam's for me, because we really feel good. We try to provide a nutritious lunch, so we serve fresh fruit with almost every meal that we serve. So he goes and he picks up 3 cases of bananas on Mondays from Sam's. If they have, and he'll first call the food bank, because if the food bank has them, then we get them for free. If they don't have them, then we have to purchase them. So he goes to Sam's, picks up 3 cases of bananas, and brings them back. Usually he gets them here Tuesday morning, so that I'll have bananas through here. Then I'm supposed to have another group right here to bring bananas to take us through to there.
Sandwiches and bananas and desserts are more needed now than any time in the SAC lunch program's history. Gene says there was a 28% increase in lunches given away between 2010 and 2011, and already this year more than 35,000 lunches have been made. She says since the economic plunge in 2008, more and more people have been showing up. On a calendar by the serving door is a somber scorecard of how much this program is in demand in Fort Smith. Each day of the month has several check marks, each one representing a lunch that was given to a child.
We never used to see kids stand in a line. It was rarity to see children. Then I started seeing more, and I thought, well, we need to keep, instead of me just saying, oh, we see a lot more kids. Well, now we track the children. And believe, you know, everybody, when they see it, they put it, or if they say that the lunch is for a child, then we put a tick mark here. So that gives us an idea of how many lunches are going for children.
And so it looks like today, the day we're talking, the 21st, there's 40 or so.
Yes. Now, in July, there was over 800, I think 890 lunches were served to children. So now here's the bread freezer over here. All right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Donated refrigerators line the wall in another room. A schedule guides volunteers to know when to transfer bread from the freezer to a fridge. And another refrigerator is the mustard. Mayo was dropped from the program to help stretch money a bit further. That sort of maneuver pays off. On days when the lunches include an orange, volunteers this year can put a whole orange in the sack instead of just half of one. The main operation here is to hand out lunches. But a line of folders along the hallway allows volunteers to help provide more information. One folder is labeled dental, another utilities. The sheets in the folders are lists of agencies that can help with each related subject. Kim Pearson says there's even a folder labeled laundry.
I love this laundry. West Ark Church of Christ, you can go once a month and they'll pay for the laundry service, like the coin-operated laundry. West Ark Church of Christ will do that. They'll also bring furniture. There's one. We need one for furniture.
11 times a week, the volunteers hand out the lunches with no forms to fill out or requirements to be met. Linda McDonough, one of the 3 co-directors, did ask people waiting in line this summer just a few questions to better track who the program is serving. 41% of respondents said they were unemployed, 12% said they're working, 17% disabled, 7% say they're homeless, 5% retired, and 18% are children. Kim Pearson says she and the other board members are constantly asking themselves how they can do better. And often, she says, difficult questions can lead to long conversations. One of those tough questions can be from a person in line asking for 2 lunches.
We've been instructed and talked about it over and over and over about just listening to your heart. What does your heart say? And the rule is that we ask them to go to the back of the line to make sure that everyone gets a sandwich before we give 2. Well, last month when I served, I think it was 110 degrees, and there was no one in the line. It was whether or not you give these 2 lunches. So the man came and he said, I'd like 2 lunches. I say, is one for a child, so we can count it. And he says, actually, they're just both for me. He says, it's just not enough. So we got to talking about the number of calories in that meal, and like, I have a 17-year-old son. That would not be, that's a snack, you know, for a 17-year-old son. So whether or not we could make the meal a few more calories in it, or whether we just go ahead and give 2 lunches to the big strapping guy. So we do. We just give him 2 lunches.
Kim says they've never run out of food. In-kind donations include all of the bread given by Mrs. Baird's Bread. Desserts are from Little Debbie's, and twice a week delivery of hot soup comes from the nearby restaurant Taliano's. St. John's Episcopal Church on North 6th donates the building space, utilities, and maintenance. There is a once-a-year SAC Lunch Sunday fundraiser, and many participating churches will sponsor an entire month. Linda McDonough says all of that reduces what should be the cost of a $1.08 per lunch to the 63 cents per lunch. And the regular volunteers, she says, make for a tight community of servers and recipients.
One time I was here, what was I doing? Maybe not making lunches, but doing something in the back, taking care of meat. And I could hear the person at the window distributing the lunches, and she was thanking them for taking the lunches. And I couldn't see, but I could hear what was going on. There's chemistry at that window, without a doubt. You know, people coming up, not to get a lunch, but to get some friendly interaction as well.
If you'd like to know more about the SAC Lunch Program in Fort Smith, there is more information, including phone numbers and addresses, at our webpage, ozarksatlarge.com. This is Ozarks at Large. To say the least, the past week for Arkansas News has included a variety of topics: marijuana, gambling, a severance tax, and jobs. Roby Bry from TalkBusiness.net has his regular Monday review of the previous 7 days.
I'm Roby Brock with your Talk Business Update, a recap of the biggest business and political headlines of the last week. For the second straight month, Arkansas's labor force declined, but in July, the employed dropouts outpaced the unemployed dropouts. Arkansas's unemployment rate rose 0.1% to 7.3% in July. The state rate is nearly a full point below a year ago when unemployment stood at 8.2%. It's also a full point below the U.S. jobless rate of 8.3%. A national trucking sector struggling through economic ups and downs hit the middle in July with no change in the American Trucking Association's Truck Tonnage Index. The index, which is considered a barometer of the U.S. economy, did not move in July after a slight 1.1% increase in June. Compared with July of 2011, the seasonally adjusted truck tonnage index was 4.1% higher, which was the largest year-over-year gain since February 2012. The Fort Smith community sent a message to U.S. Representative Randy Forbes, Republican from Virginia, on Tuesday night at the Defending Our Defenders listening session. Forbes, chairman of the House Armed Services Subcommittee on Readiness, is reviewing possible scalebacks and closures of military units across the country in an effort to reduce federal government spending. The Fort Smith-based 188th Fighter Wing could possibly be closed as a result of cuts to defense spending. While no agreement's been reached, the parent company of Northwest Medical System has decided to honor its existing contract with Arkansas Blue Cross Blue Shield beyond September 1st. Franklin, Tennessee-based Community Health Systems previously said it would quit doing business with Blue Cross after the insurer would not agree to rate increases for services. Community Health owns hospitals and clinics in Northwest Arkansas, as well as facilities in El Dorado, Forest City, Helena, and Newport. Presumptive GOP presidential nominee Mitt Romney attended a series of in-state fundraisers, collecting more than $2 million in Arkansas on Wednesday night. Romney held multiple photo opportunities with donors at the Peabody and Capitol Hotels in Little Rock. The fundraising hall was touted as the single biggest political fundraiser in Arkansas history. A plethora of ballot initiative activity kept Secretary of State Mark Martin busy all week. Martin rejected a substitute ballot title for a casino gambling proposal, and the measure's main proponent vowed a court challenge. Martin ruled that Nancy Todd, whose Nancy Todd Poker Palace proposal would allow casino operations in 4 Arkansas counties, did not clarify her ballot title sufficiently to help voters understand that passage of her amendment could affect existing electronic games of skill operations at Oaklawn and Southland racetracks. Todd did submit more than 100,000 additional signatures to qualify the measure for the November ballot, but the Arkansas Supreme Court must ultimately rule on the ballot title issue for the proposal to move forward. Arkansans will decide whether or not to allow for legalized medicinal marijuana this November. A group pushing for passage of the measure, Arkansans for Compassionate Care, was notified by Martin on Wednesday that it had qualified for the November ballot after turning in an additional 74,000 signatures on petitions. And Sheffield Nelson, leader of a group pushing for a higher severance tax on natural gas, did not meet a deadline to turn in more signatures to qualify his proposal for the ballot. Nelson said he may take up the campaign again in the future. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Update.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me in the studio is Martin Miller, who is the managing director of Theater Squared, and Morgan Hicks, who is directing the first feature this year, which is Noises Off, but you also have another title.
I'm the director of education and program development at Theater Squared.
I think we've set a record for most time saying director in an introduction to an interview. Noises Off opens August 30th. It opens the seventh season of Theater Squared. This is exciting.
Yes, we have been building up to this all summer, quite literally, in our new scene shop, which we just got partway through last year. This is probably the most ambitious, it's the most ambitious season we've done, and this is the most ambitious set we've ever built. Not to give too much away, but it does require that both sides of the set be ready for audience enjoyment. So there's quite a lot of things that need to be on wheels and things that need to move in and off, and often very tall things. So anyway, it's quite the set.
Morgan, early in the rehearsal process, you had put some photos up on Facebook.
That's right.
And I haven't seen any of those lately.
Right. The set is evolving, and we decided that we would keep the surprise for the audience. So we decided sort of as a group that we would do close-ups, and we could take some pictures of props or faces, but we wouldn't take any more pictures of the set as it developed. So what is still on Facebook are some structural things, some 2x4s and some raw wood. But yeah, we wanted to keep what the set will actually look like a surprise.
It's a play within a play.
It's a play within a play.
9-person cast.
It is.
A set that moves.
Yes. 13 doors, 13, two stories.
13 doors, two stories, precision timing required.
Yes. Yes. The device of the play is that we're watching the first act. The first act is the last rehearsal, the last dress rehearsal of this production that's going to be going on the road. So we see the very last last dress rehearsal, which is taking us into the night. It's about 1 o'clock in the morning by the time that they're finished with this dress rehearsal. Then the second act is we're watching this show backstage while the show is going on, and then the third act is the final performance of the tour. So we're watching the whole process of a theatrical event from beginning to end.
So you'll see some things happen more than once.
It's
but
true.
From different perspectives.
Yeah, the playwright actually writes, it's a 3-act play that is described as act one, act one, and act one. Yeah. So the third time you see act one, it's much more illuminating than the first time you see it.
There's a certain factor for the audience at certain moments. Like,
right.
Oh, I see.
Right.
Now, yeah.
Yeah. And there are two different plays going on at once during act two. So we're seeing act one, but we're also seeing act two simultaneously.
Now, for a novice, Morgan, this sounds like it would be tougher to direct than another show. But is it just another show as far as a director? I mean, all shows have their own challenges.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I think all shows have challenges and all shows are exciting in different ways. But the math of the show was particularly exciting to me. And we just, you know, we did Boeing last year. We did that, a big farce with 7 doors. And so as we were approaching this one, I was like, okay, well, it'll be like that. It's very precise. The doors have to open and close at the right moments in order for the comedy to work. And it'll be about getting all of that math down. This show is a lot more complicated than that, as far as just
more like calculus than algebra.
Yeah.
It's advanced math. It is advanced. And the actors that we have are doing an extraordinary job. We have just kind of a stellar crew working on it and trying to figure it out. But it takes every single brain in the room to be kind of at full capacity in every moment to make it work. Yeah.
That's what starts the season. Mm-hmm. Then you have, I mean, when people think Christmas and comedy, they think Tennessee Williams.
Yeah.
If they didn't yet.
They will.
They will. It's his only comedy. He described it as his only comedy. Somebody wrote a column saying that what Tennessee Williams, all he ever does is plunge into the sewer of human nature. And so Tennessee Williams went, no, I don't. Here's a comedy. But in doing so, he said, listen, a comedy plumbs the same depths, and a drama goes to the same heights. Every great work of theater has these same extremes. The way that a play happens to end shouldn't define what you call the play, even though it does. we're calling it a comedy. It is a comedy. But yeah, it's a really smart work by one of the greatest American playwrights that has been chronically underproduced for the last 50 years. And it was basically rediscovered in England by the Almeida Theatre, which is this great company. They love Tennessee Williams in London. And it was a production that took all sorts of critics and the public by surprise because everyone, what happened to this play? It hasn't been produced since like 1960. I was lucky enough to see that show and then reading a lot of the discussion of it, you know. We have been looking at it for a couple of years now, and this felt like the right year to do it. It's not A Christmas Carol, you know, mm-hmm. or it's not our reimagining of It's a Wonderful Life like we did last year. It's less of a household name, but it is, it should be.
Yeah,
it's really sweet.
It has a beautiful journey that is not unsimilar to something like And It's a Wonderful Life. And it's not the chestnut. It's not the expected title for A Christmas slot. And I think that's, you know, we talk about seasons planning being this alchemy, and this year it just seemed like the right time to do a show that had a beautiful story that was set on Christmas Eve and wasn't necessarily the expected title.
Right. It's two couples. They are, one of them is newlywed as of, you know, one catastrophic night before, and the other one that's, I think, about 8 to 10 years into their marriage, and that the second marriage, the wife has, it opens on the character sitting alone because his wife has left along with their son, and then the newlywed couple arrives, and it's you mentioned sitcom a couple minutes ago. If you watch the movie version of this one, it has a very sitcom-y feel as well, which is, we think, probably the wrong take on it. There's a lot of comedy in it, but there's a lot of heart as well. When I saw it in London, you just really fall in love with these characters, and you see yourself. I mean, kind of the classic tropes that you mm-hmm. that you say when you talk about a great play. It does that, and it also happens to occur on Christmas Eve. The whole play takes place on Christmas Eve, and so it ties into that really nicely. I think it's a very nice way to bring your family out, or just your wife or your boyfriend or whomever, to see a play with you in December.
And that'll be in December. Sons of the Prophet is the third one. That's a play that hasn't been produced much outside of New York.
Hasn't been produced at all since its New York debut.
There you go. That's not much.
Yeah, and the reason for that is not that it's been forgotten in the sands of time.
It's
like
very current.
Period of adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
It, all of the awards it's won were 2012 awards. It was a finalist for the 2012 Pulitzer Prize. It won the 2012 New York Outer Critics Award. It won a 2012 Obie Award. That's how new this play is. Through some sort of miracle, we were able to become one of the first theaters in the country to be granted the rights. And in fact, our scheduled production date for the show, no one has yet announced an earlier production date for the show. So basically, Theater Squared,
the
at
outside
the Vanguard.
Of New York.
Yeah,
wow.
Exactly. And this was a big play. This is a play that, you know, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, all of them put them among their top 10 plays of the year, some of them of the decade. And it's really exciting also to, I'll just announce right here on your show, Kyle, that we got the final confirmation that in partnership with the Fayetteville Public Library, I'm pointing across the street from the KUF
yes.
headquarters, we are going to actually be bringing in Stephen Karam, the playwright of Sons of the Prophet, during the rehearsal process. We'll be having a conversation you'll take part in at the library.
That'll be fantastic.
And that's really great. I mean, this guy is happening. He's basically one of the biggest new names in playwriting right now nationally, and he's coming right here to Fayetteville to take part.
It's an exciting seventh season. It begins with Noises Off, August 30th. Tickets still available?
Yes, they are. Although I have to say it's selling fast. I got a report today from the Walton Arts Center that I was like, wow, that's a big number for a week and a half out. So I would recommend that folks get out there and get some seats.
True, this run cannot be extended?
It cannot True. Because of a phenomenon in Fayetteville known as Bikes, Blues, and Barbecue, whereby anyone – I don't believe the Walton Arts Center attempts to produce that weekend either. It's just really tough to get anywhere near that area. And even if you were to get into the theater, I think the rumble of bikes would quite drown out the show.
It would not be noises off.
No, it would just it would be noises
out there.
If people want to know more about Noises Off for the rest of the season, they can go to the website.
Yep, theater2.org.
It's a two.
Yes, the number two. Although they could spell it out and they'd get there too.
Oh, would they?
Yes, they would.
Oh, well, that's smart.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
I think get a group together, come see the show. We'll see you there. It's really glad you could have us on to talk about it.
Right, Miller, Morgan Hicks, thank you both very much.
Thanks, Kyle.
Thanks, Kyle.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas Songs.
I met Jody at the rodeo. Later on, we dosed go down at the Casey Hall. But much a romance ended at a dance when she caught me with Melinda McCall, who promised she would marry me, but first she had to carry me to meet her parents out in L.A. But the whole thing degraded me cause Daddy hated me and canceled every plan we made. Oh, there's been a whole lot of near misses in my life.
Sean Camp was born in Perryville, northwest of Little Rock. Although he's known as a hit country songwriter for other artists these days, in the early 1990s, Sean Camp was a rising country star. 5 years after he moved to Nashville, Sean Camp had signed as a solo act to Reprise Records, a subsidiary label of Warner Brothers, in 1992. The Arkansasian released his self-titled debut album the next year with musicians like James Burton, Roy Husky Jr., Allison Krauss, and Shelby Lynn. Camp wrote most of the songs and played dobro, fiddle, and guitar. The Sean Camp album didn't go over big, but it did well enough to warrant a follow-up. That's where things started to go awry.
Didn't know my heart was in harm's way. Couldn't see the truth till it was in my face. If I'd seen it coming, could have turned away. Didn't know.
Sean Camp grew up in Perry County with his family, surrounded by bluegrass music. He got a start on the national country scene playing fiddle with the Osborne Brothers. So it should come as no surprise that he's a traditionalist when it comes to country music. Camp's 1994 follow-up album featured players like Jerry Douglas, Bobby Hicks, and Bill Monroe. But the label rejected the songs as too country and asked for less fiddle and dobro and more electric guitar. Camp recalls being told his album didn't sound like the current John Michael Montgomery album. In turn, Camp asked to be given a release date for the second Sean Camp album as it was, or be given a release from his major label contract. The company released Sean Camp from his contract, and the album went into the vault.
Shattered inside and scattered around, were pieces of her broken heart. I gathered her up, the pieces I found, put her back together like a busted guitar. But some glue holds and some glue don't, in spite of everything I tried. Somebody stole my darling right before my very eyes. He didn't walk, talk, or push his way in, or fly through the window on a gust of hot wind. He didn't sprattle wings, and he sure wasn't playing no harp. Low as he was, I couldn't see him slithering around in the dark. Lord, he must have crawled through a little bitty crack in her heart.
The multi-talented Sean Camp found another way to crash the gates of Nashville music as a songwriter. Sean Camp's songs have been recorded by Garth Brooks, George Strait, Brooks and Dunn, John Anderson, Josh Turner, and more. He's co-written songs with Loretta Lynn, Guy Clark, and Jim Lauderdale. More than 15 years later, Reprise Nashville finally issued Sean Camp's long-dismissed second album in fall of 2010 with the title 1994, named after the year it was made. The label also re-released the Arkansasian's debut album in tandem with the release of the album 1994. Shirley Camp's subsequent chart success as a songwriter didn't hurt with the change of heart over the release of the once-lost Sean Camp album.
Well, I told my little darling better start to pack. Next month we'll be living over across the tracks. The owner of the plant's finally giving in. He don't want to see our picket line again, so let's call it a pizza.
a baby to celebrate. But up that ironing board and pour us both a drink. Honey, all our dreams are finally coming true. We're gonna start living like the rich folks do. We're moving on up to a double wide. Parking our pickup every day with pride. Bank we got it made for the rest of our lives. We're moving on up to a double wide.
Nashville doesn't offer many second chances to its artists, much less to its recordings by artists who didn't make it big the first time around. There's a testament to the talent and tenacity of Sean Camp that he got both. Here in its entirety is Sean Camp of Perryville in Perry County with In Harm's Way, with Patty Loveless on backing vocals. Arkansas-er Sean Camp of Perryville in Perry County with In Harm's Way, recorded in 1994 and only released years later in fall 2010 on the Sean Camp album called 1994. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. For more information, visit arkansongs.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. The Ozark Poets and Writers Collective will welcome writer Tom Andes to Northwest Arkansas tomorrow night. He'll be reading at 7 at Nightbird Books on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. Tom is a former Fayetteville resident, and he now lives in New Orleans. One of his short stories has just been accepted to be included in the 2012 edition of America's Best Mystery Writing. Last week, I called Tom Andes and asked him about that story and about how he prepares for a reading.
I guess a lot of times when I read, like, I won't wing it, but, like, I'll wait. I'll usually try to bring something, like, relatively current or something that, like, is kind of, like, that I'm working on that's still kind of, like, with me. I have a story I published online in the spring that I actually really like reading in front of an audience because I've read it a few times and like I've gotten to sort of know like its little soft spots and like the little moments that I can pause. But I read that the last time I was in Fayetteville to read. So I'm actually probably going to read, something actually that was sort of an unexpected. I'd put away for a while and I just sort of gave it to some friends to read this summer and got some positive feedback about it, and it's probably just about the right length. One of the dilemmas I always have when I'm asked to read is, like, if you're reading fiction, you know, like, how to fit. If the story takes 15 minutes to read, that's great. If it's, like, a 20-page story, it's hard to cram it in, you know, to whatever sort of time frame you're allotted. So that's always sort of a dilemma, is whether I'm going to excerpt something or read something that I can read in its entirety. But I'm actually kind of still making up my mind about that. I try to read something that's just kind of like, I feel like something that's like current and something that's kind of like with me that I sort of feel good about, you know, that I can read in front of an audience as opposed to something that's like older. It's like I'll kind of try to do when somebody asks me to read.
Do you read before the first time you read something in front of an audience, will you read it for yourself out loud?
I guess it depends. I mean, I will actually sometimes when I'm working on something, I will sometimes read it out loud to myself, to kind of get a sense of where, you know, what words can go and what words I can sort of chip out of something. So a lot of the stuff I have, like if it's pretty far along, I've just as sort of part of the way like I work sometimes, I will have read it out loud to myself. But I will, if I read it out loud to myself, I will usually do it to time it. Like to see, you know, if somebody says you have 15 minutes, I'll sit down with a couple things and sort of see what fits best into that time frame and kind of get a sense. I think I tend to talk very fast. And I'm aware of, like, changing my pacing when I read in front of people. So that kind of factors into the way I think about that stuff, too.
I don't imagine when you're writing, you're thinking about how this will sound out loud.
No, you don't. I mean, I guess not. God, that's actually a good question. I mean, I don't. But there's definitely something to, like, I mean, it's funny. Like, it looks one way on a word processor screen. It looks another way when you print it off. And then it sounds another way when you sort of read it. And I think so. No, I mean, I don't think about it when I'm, but there is, I think there's an extent to which even if you like, if, you know, if you were to open a book now, you read something, you kind of, you do hear it in a way. And so like, it isn't usually like, if I'm like kind of at any initial stages of writing something, I don't usually think about how it sounds, but it's more kind of as something develops, if something is like kind of starting to come along and I'm starting to kind of revise it and develop it, that's kind of the point at which I'll start to read it out loud to myself, because it gives me sort of a sense of like just the way it sounds. And again, sort of a sense of like what words I can kind of, sometimes what words I can take out, you know, like often, I don't know if other people do this, but I sort of often find myself saying the same thing twice, you know, and I can hear that better sometimes than I can read it, if that makes sense.
It does, yeah. Do you, I mean, obviously there are some things you write that will never be read aloud.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. Go ahead, is there more of that question?
Well, yeah, is a piece of fiction that you would write that sounds better out loud than one that doesn't, are they two different types of writing, or it's just that one sounds better orally than the other?
I wouldn't say they're two different types, but yeah, I mean, I guess there's like kind of a spectrum of how those, I mean, yeah, there's certain things, it's funny, there are certain things that seem to work really well when reading them in front of a crowd. But I mean, I think like if you go hear people, you know, there's like, it can be the most wonderful thing when you like go to a reading and you hear somebody read, And they have, there's that moment in the story where like everybody in the bar, or everybody in the bookstore, or everybody in wherever the venue is like kind of holding, you know, their collective breath while something happens. And like, I think that's actually a really nice moment. And I think that moment often, you know, I think there is actually really a connection between sort of like oral stories and written stories, because I think that those moments often translate really, really well to the page. But I mean, yeah, there's certain things, you know, if you're writing sort of in a more, I think a more stream of consciousness style, like I imagine Proust is, you know, one experience to hear out loud, and, you know, Hemingway an entirely different experience to hear out loud or something like that. So I think they're, you know, I would say like maybe not different types of stories, but certainly like, you know, certainly there's a spectrum of the way you hear something and the way you experience something. But I mean, I find that like I really enjoy that. I really enjoy that aspect of like my stuff, and it's always really kind of revealing to me. It's often really revealing to me if there's something I've been working on for a while, you know, where it's pretty far along, to read it in front of people, because you can kind of sense, you know, when their attention strays, and you can also kind of sense sometimes when they are like holding on to what they're hearing. And I think you can sense, you know, if they laugh, you know, there are moments sometimes where like, I'm not sure if their people are going to get the joke. And then when they laugh, I'm like, oh, they get the joke. They're kind of with me on this. And that's always like, I mean, that's always it's just a nice moment, I think, as a writer. And it's always reassuring.
Would you ever change something on the written page based on how it might, especially if it's something current or maybe not completely finished or polished, would you ever change something on the written page based on how it was received when you read it?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, I think reading something out loud can definitely kind of teach you, you know, I mean, and it's funny, you know, I've done like workshops where I did like kind of a residency this summer where we would sort of bring our work to these workshop sessions, and mostly we'd read it out loud instead of having it to read beforehand. And, you know, I could hear sometimes, you know, and obviously this is a different context than a reading, but I could actually hear sometimes where I'd be like, oh, like I totally don't need that sentence right there, you know. And so like I think the act of, which is what I, you know, that's the sort of the sense I try to duplicate, you know, when I'm sitting like by myself reading something off the page out loud to myself, or, you know, in front of and I think the same thing can happen, you know, in front of a bookstore or whatever, you know, where you read, you sort of get a different sense of something, you know, and you can sort of feel like, oh, like maybe they, you know, you can tell maybe they already got that. So it's redundant for me to kind of go on for that one additional sentence, you know, the last sentence of the paragraph, say, or whatever. So, yeah, I mean, I think it can actually kind of teach you a little bit about your stories. And I think I've definitely responded to that when I've sensed that, you know, in a number of different contexts, reading out loud.
You have a short story called The Hit that's going to be included in the Best American Mystery Writing of 2012. Is that correct?
Yes, that is. That is.
I mean, that's quite an honor.
It's probably the most amazing thing that has happened to me so far in my career, and something that I feel was kind of completely serendipitous and not something that I saw coming at all. It was really, and it's a funny, I mean, the whole evolution of that story is really interesting. It's set in San Francisco. It's one of the few stories I've ever set in San Francisco. And I wrote it when I moved there in 2001. And I tried to make it into a novel. I wrote like 80 or 100 pages of backstory for one of the main characters that never went anywhere. And I put it away and I kind of given up on it for 8 or 9 years. And then took it out of an envelope sort of on a whim at a residency a couple of years ago and basically realized that all I had to do to kind of make it work was take the first 5 pages off, and then it would probably work if I, you know, with some editing and some more kind of like light revision. It's pretty amazing to, you know, it's amazing. I feel myself sort of, I'm still a little stunned by the fact that they took that, and I'm really happy that they took it. And I think it goes to show you, you know, like that's a piece I've given up on. You know, I'd given up on that piece kind of like time and again. So it gives me like sort of a sense that sometimes I think you just sort of have to have faith in your own, you know, in your own forward motion and letting things get out there. And I should also say too that I almost the editor of the magazine where it appeared, Xavier Review, is a friend of mine, Ralph Adamo, and it was sort of serendipitous that he took it for that magazine and then sort of forwarded it along to the people to look at it for that anthology. So I'm very grateful to him for doing that too.
And you know, Daniel Woodrell has a story in there, Charles Todd. So this is and it comes out every October, so people can look for that in just a couple of months.
Yeah, it'll be out. It's intimidating when they accepted it and they asked for like a bio and like a little paragraph about the story, and like they send you samples of like the previous year's contributors, and it was like, I think like James Lee Burke, like they sent me people who I've like read and admired for years, and I was like, it just feels weird to be like sending something. But I mean, you know, again, it's sort of like, it's a beautiful thing. And I think the funny thing with writing, you know, is that a lot of times you don't know, you just throw stuff out there in the world, and you don't know where it's going to end up. And so when it ends up someplace like that, it's amazing, you know. But you just sort of have to keep putting things out there in the world, and, you know, and then, like, that's an amazing thing to have happen. And I think, like, I felt really emboldened after I found out about that. So I sent, like, a bunch of stories, like, 100 places, and got them all turned down. I mean, it's, you know, you just sort of keep doing it on a daily basis. But, yeah, definitely something like that is, like, is really, I don't know, it's pretty amazing company, definitely. So I'm just, yeah, I was thrilled. And I think some other Arkansas people have been in there too. I know a couple of people who have, I think, maybe even gone to the MFA program at the U of A, have been in there in recent years.
Michael Downs, who earned an MFA here some time ago, he was in maybe 2 or 3 years ago.
Okay, yeah. Story. And I think, yeah, I forget, I think Nick Pizzolatto, who went there.
Yes, a few people. Yes. Nick was
there. There's a handful.
Yes.
And I think it's actually funny too, because I got my friend Ralph publishes Xavier Review, which is the magazine that I had a story in, and then the New Orleans Review. There's also a story from the New Orleans Review that's going to be in there this year, so that's kind of exciting. Like, two of the New Orleans literary magazines are both going to have stories in that magazine, in that anthology this year. So that's pretty exciting too.
Tom Andes will read his work tomorrow night at 7. At Nightbird Books on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. He'll be the guest of the Ozark Poets and Writers Collective. I talked with him last week from his home in New Orleans. It is Monday, August 27th, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me on the phone from her news desk at the Northwest Arkansas Newspaper headquarters is Becca Martin Brown. She's features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. How is work going for you on this Monday?
It's all right. I'm afraid to come out. There's stuff falling out of the sky off and on.
Yeah, we have a meteorologist looking into that.
Oh, good. Well, let me know if it's oobleck or what it is.
Well, if we dare to go outside, brave the elements, what could we find?
Well, you could go outside to go inside.
Okay.
Because you could go to the Bentonville Public Library and see a Rogers Historical Museum exhibit. Was that confusing?
No, I'm following you.
Okay. It's called Virgil Lovelace and Life on the Farm. And it's an exhibit about a local boy at the turn of the century who grew up, moved away, and came home. Great images of life on the farm at the turn of the 20th century. And it's up through September 28th at the Bentonville Public Library.
So all you got to do is walk into the library, and it's free.
And if things quit falling out of the sky, the Washington County Fair opens tonight.
Well, I think it opens no matter what, right?
Okay. It will open. Whether you want to go there depends on what's falling out of the sky.
There you go.
But I will tell you that admission is $5 for adults, free for 6 and younger. And tomorrow night is $2 admission and $2 carnival rides.
That's quite the bargain.
And you can find out more at mywashingtoncountyfair.com.
All right. Well, have a pleasant Monday.
You too.
Becca Martin Brown is the features editor in Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. And that's almost all the time we have for this edition of Ozarks at Large for this Monday, August 27th, 2012. SONA, the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas, begins its 2012-2013 season Sunday, September 16th at 3 p.m. at Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. The opening concert will include Wagner's Tannhauser Overture, Barber's Violin Concerto featuring soloist Winona Fifield, and Brahms Symphony No. 2. Tickets available at 443-5600 or sonamusic.org. And the KUAF website giveaway in Walton Arts Center offering you the chance to win 2 tickets to the 10x10 Art Series. Productions include L.A. Theater Work, Circa, and more. The drawing is Friday, September 14th during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Registration and information available at KUAF.com. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening. Antoinette Grajeda, who was by my side throughout the week on stage at the KUAF main stage at Walton Arts Center for the Roots Festival, back with me tomorrow at noon. Thanks to everyone who helped make our first ever live show in front of a studio audience on Friday a smashing success. Maybe we'll do it again. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, St. Paul. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for tuning in. Have a great Monday.